Hey, you've made it to the podcast Recovery Captured, hosted by me, Shannon Louise, a certified recovery coach and self-verified addict. Join me on my journey through my recovery from mind-altering substances, eating disorders, depression, and much, much more. During this podcast, you'll hear my personal experience, thoughts, and opinions, as well as my guests' stories through their own recovery. I hope that you're able to take something away from this podcast and use it as a tool to help you see that your story is picture perfect. And here we are. Welcome, Andrew. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Super excited to have you. Thank you.
Oh, this is so fun. I'm excited.
Me too. So let us know the goods. What are you in recovery for? What is your recovery date? And give us a fun fact about you.
Let's go backwards. Yeah. Fun fact about me. What about a weird fact? Let's do a weird fact.
Weird fact.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have 7 brothers and sisters, all from the same father, but a different mother. Mm-hmm. And my father was 52 when he had me, and my mother was 18. I have some nieces that are the same age, if not older than me. So there is some weirdness for you. And then what do we got? We got a recovery date. So I'm actually approaching my 18 years. May 24th, 2003 is when I put down a drink and all drugs. I was into pretty much whatever you had, but mainly booze. Booze was definitely my first love. I kind of got that at a very young age. It was around the house, and I just, you know, one day got this great idea when a friend was coming over. He was bringing some marijuana, and I had lied to him and told him that I had smoked weed before. This was during dare season, not deer season, dare season. Yeah.
D-A-R-E.
Exactly. Yeah. It's when the cop came in fifth grade or whatever and told you what drugs you were going to do someday. Mm-hmm. So that sparked the conversation about, weed. His mom actually grew it. And I said, yeah, why don't you come over after school? We'll get after it. No idea what that even meant. And, so I got this crazy idea that I should have a drink, because I saw my family doing it, and so soon as I put that drink in my body, I like got so much relief from it. Like, I had this ball of anger, discomfort. Really didn't know what it was actually, but it didn't feel good, and I didn't. Even if I could talk about it, I don't even know how I would explain what was going on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, inside me. So, but that drink, man, it alleviated it. It also gave me the ability to smoke weed. It's like he came over and it was just like this natural kind of next step. And from that point on, I did whatever I could do to drink, stole it from my family. I was, being so young, like it wasn't like I could go to the store and buy it. Mm-hmm. I did have some nieces and nephews that were older than me, like I mentioned earlier, and they had the older kids. And so I was able to get it.
I never really, I knew you had siblings. I didn't think I knew that you had 7 of them. Mm. And I feel like I've known you for my entire sobriety, so over 8 years. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that fun fact about you.
Yeah, and 4 are half sisters and the other three are half brothers. Mm. And everybody averages about two kids. Some have three. I think one of them has one maybe, but their kids have kids. Mm. So, I mean, I'm not going to get too much in the weeds because there's a lot of them. But one of my nieces, who is more like my sister because we grew up, you know, she's about a year older than I am. So we like went to the same classes, you know, so she has a child who just had a child, which is crazy. So that means I have a great, I think grandniece, I think is what you call it, maybe.
I have no idea.
So it's great, my niece. It's my niece's daughter's daughter. So whatever that is, I got one of them.
We got a few greats in there.
Oof, crazy.
You said you're almost 19 years sober?
18.
18?
Yep, and I got sober at 18.
Look at that.
I'll do the math for everybody. That means I'm 36 years old. I really buzz me when people like tell you all the things and you're like, fuck, now I got to listen to you still and try to figure out the math at the same time. It's like, what are you doing to me? So, 36 years old.
I appreciate that. No, we all needed to know that fact, and it's so true because we all sit there trying to figure out.
And try to listen to the person that's talking and try to figure out, you know. Anyways.
And then everything else that comes from it. But anyways, so I remember I was working at V4 when you turned your sweet 16.
Sweet 16.
Mm. I got you a card. The first thing you said, I'm surprised you didn't give me a sweet 16 card.
Yeah, I was so shocked. I was like, what is up with people? That's what I would do.
Uh-huh.
You know, somebody's turning 16. Come on.
Oh, man. I missed my opportunity, but we have 8 more years, and then you can get mine.
Yep. Yeah, we'll have another chance. We'll have another chance. I'm excited for that day.
There we go.
Yep.
Someday. Yep. Someday mm-hmm. soon. All right, so you kind of started a little bit about when you first picked up.
Yeah.
Give us the deets about what it was like before, what you went through, like, on the other side.
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, I picked up really young, and, you know, that just set in motion, like, just this desire to feel that way as much as I could. Mm-hmm. So... kind of the problem with that, like I said, being so young, it wasn't like, you know, I could get a job and go buy it. So I started doing some shady behavior right out the gate. You know, I would do beanies, break and enterings all the time, and literally just to steal booze.
Beanies?
BNEs, break and entering. Not beanies, like what you put on your head.
I never knew that.
Yeah, I used to do that a lot with some other people. Definitely, you know, got in with the older crowd. Mm-hmm. And like, it just blows my mind. Like when I see, you know, like when I see people that are drinking, when I see kids and I'm like, shit, I was drinking at that age. I just, it's almost hard to comprehend.
Right. You know, imagine like, when you have kids.
I just can't. It just blows my mind. So anyways, so that kind of started that. And I have another issue is I get very loud and vocal when I drink, even at a young age. So I got in a lot of trouble there with policemen and at school. I started getting in the habit of, you know, once I figured out like a system, I had a pretty good system of how to like steal it from my parents and, you know, I called them buyers at the time. I found people of age to buy me booze. Those were my buyers. I had a handful of them. So it was really weird. Like these people had some kind of moral compass where they wouldn't like buy for me like more than in one day or more than X amount of days put together. Like it's like you're buying for a minor. What's it matter if you buy for me in twice in one day? Anyways. So I would get this system where I could stay, you know, getting the booze when I wanted. But that once I figured out that I could like skip school at 10 o'clock in the morning and like go drink, like I started doing that on a regular basis. Because, you know, for me, like what alcohol really did for me was like it really took me, you know, to a place where it really didn't matter what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a lot of insecurities. I, you know, that my parents' 30 some odd years age gap, and, you know, explaining to kids at school why my niece and I, how she's my niece, you know, those all, and like, they told me I had a learning disability. So I just had all this stuff where, you know, I didn't really know how to comprehend it. So like when I would drink it, like none of that stuff mattered anymore. Like it did not matter. And that's what I wanted. I wanted relief whenever possible. So it was just a matter of time before like school, as soon as I turned 16, school was done. As soon as I could leave the house, I did. You know, my father and my mother got divorced when I was 14. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd do the parent shuffle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I liked my mom because she let me get away with whatever I wanted. Mm-hmm. My father was too disciplined. And so, you know, I tried to live with him like one time because I was trying to not, I don't know if I was trying not to drink, but it was like I didn't want to continue getting in trouble. So I was like, oh, if I stay at my father's, I won't drink as much. Like, as soon as I got there, first paycheck, I bought a mini fridge and put it in my closet and stacked it full of beer. You know what I mean? Like,
you so know. That's like the first step of your controlling
my father's discipline, which, you know, uh-huh. didn't work at all. You know, and then after that, go at it. You know, I got a girlfriend. I thought the girlfriend was going to fix some stuff, and I did pretty good. I lasted like a month. I smoked some weed in the middle because it wasn't like, you know, weed wasn't the problem. Mm-hmm. It was the booze. And, you know, shortly after that I was drinking and full on issues.
Well, at that age, did you know that that drinking was an issue?
Yeah. So by the time, right around 16, I had picked up a bunch of charges. Mainly they were either disorderly conducts or open containers. I'm like a get up and go kind of. Yeah, I think like I'm a kid, right? So mm-hmm. it's not like I can go home and drink. You know, a lot of people, they go to the bar, or they go to their, like, I can't do that. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, I would find people that would let me drink at their house, but it's not like I live there. You know what I mean? It's not like they're going to let a minor sleep over, which probably should. If you're going to allow minors drink, you should probably let them stay at your house. So, you know, I'd catch myself like walking around town. I grew up in a small town in Vermont, and you know, we used to scoop the loop is what we called it.
Scoop in the loop.
Yeah, Bells Falls, Vermont, scoop in the loop.
I've never heard that.
Yep. If you're a local, you know what that means. Shout out to Bells Falls. So yeah, it was just a matter of time before I was like picking up a bunch of charges. And so people started saying, you know, Andrew, you have a problem with alcohol. And I'm like, I don't have a problem. You have the problem. Mm-hmm. I'm perfectly content drinking mm-hmm. the way I'm drinking. And drugs started getting involved. And you know, I was just doing whatever anybody had. You know, booze gave me what I need. And it was, you know, usually cheap. You know, for me, I wasn't a classy drinker by any means. 5 o'clock vodka and Natty Ice, those are, you know, my go-tos, you know, if you yep. only get a couple bucks.
Mm-hmm. I think we've all been there before.
That's where I go.
That's where I was when I ended and when I started, so.
You started where you ended.
Exactly.
Yeah, nice.
That's right.
Where you ended, where you started. Anyways.
No, I got you.
Yeah, so, like, I just, you know, started getting more and more legal trouble. Mm-hmm. Got caught with drugs, and you know, they started putting me in like anger management. They thought that was the problem for a little bit. I did therapy, went to, you know, Woodside. It's shut mm-hmm. down now, but I was at Woodside for a little bit. I went into foster care for a little while, for like a weekend, and then they're like, "We gotta charge you as an adult." And I was like, "What?" I don't know what this even means.
Huh, I didn't know that either about you.
Yeah, did that for a little bit. And then, let's see, you know, at this point, you know, by the time I was 18, I had done pretty much everything except for inpatient treatment. Mm-hmm. And not sure really why, but they just never really offered it to me. And I was in Claremont, New Hampshire, trying to be a drug dealer over there. Come to find out, I'm not a drug dealer. They threw me in jail pretty quickly, and they charged me with a few things, and they were going to run it concurrent with the charges that I had already going in mm-hmm. Vermont. They shipped me over to Vermont, and that's when they actually offered me treatment. And I had no intentions of actually getting sober when I got to treatment at all. I brought drugs in with me. Like, there was no... you know, I'm going to find a spiritual way of life and become a successful person. Like, that wasn't at all. I was just, they made me an offer that either I could go back to jail for 6 months or I could go to treatment for 3. And they said treatment was co-ed.
Is that Maple Leaf?
Jail is not co-ed, if anybody's listening, or at least any ones that I've been to.
Did you go to Maple Leaf?
I did not. I went to a place called Mountain View, which was in Huntington, Vermont. Mm-hmm. And they, at that time, their Phoenix House actually is, not a spinoff. That's where they got their funding, was Phoenix House. And they dealt with people, basically teenagers to like 23, which I don't know who thought that was a good idea to put like minors and adults, men and women together, but it was not a good idea. Like, there was so much not good stuff happening. They actually did get shut down. I was, I think, 9 months sober. I wanted to go back there and, like, you know, tell my story, and then they shut down. So they must have knew I was coming. That's probably why they shut down. Yeah, I haven't drank or drugged ever since.
Is that crazy to you?
Blows my mind. Blows my mind that I'm almost the age I got sober, which was 18. I'm about to be 18 sobriety, you know, so it just blows my mind.
So when you went to rehab, that was the last time you ever picked up a drink or a drug?
Yep. Yep.
You didn't have that, like, little bender when people get out and they do that, like, that quick, like, hey, let's drink a little and then...
No, I drank a lot of Red Bulls. A lot of Red Bulls. I smoked a lot of Newport cigarettes. Had a lot of girlfriends. I did some criminal activity, actually, as well. I did a lot of stuff that you would think would actually have me... actually go back out, you know. There's a lot of things, whatever program you kind of get into, you know, they kind of map out, you know, what you shouldn't do because you could drink, and I like did all of that. And, you know, I don't know, maybe that's why I am still here, because, you know, like, I was doing all this stuff and it kind of gave me that thrill or so. I don't really know, but I was very fortunate because there were some other people, you know, that got sober around that time that are not here, you know, and they were doing a lot of the same stuff. So I don't really know, but.
So when you said that you picked up like Red Bulls and you had lady friends and all this other stuff, did you see it as you were exchanging one drug for another or one addiction for another? You know what I mean?
I mean, at that time, I don't think I really paid attention to it. I was just like, I want to feel good right now, and I'm going to do whatever I have to do that without picking up or drink or drug. And that's pretty much was my mindset. As long as I don't drink, I'm cool. And, you know, they're in the program that I'm in, they would say that no matter what, don't drink. And that's, I like took that so literally that I, you know, and I caused actually a lot of harm that way. And, you know, I've cleaned a lot of that up over my period of sobriety. You know, I've been fortunate enough to eventually that behavior stopped working. You know, just like a drink and a drug, like that stopped working, and it was going to kill me. And the kind of destructive behavior and harming others, whether it was inadvertently or externally or whatever, like that stopped working too. You know, I got to a place when I was about a year and a half without a drink or a drug where drinking seemed to be a good idea, and also killing myself seemed like a good idea. And killing myself has never been a good, like, that was never a thought of mine. Even when I was out there, I mean, there were times where I was like, I wish I wouldn't wake up, or there are times where you know, I maybe even said, hey God, you know, take me out. kind of deal. I mean, there was one time I took a lot of ecstasy, and I was very inexperienced with ecstasy and didn't know that, like, the next day is probably going to be pretty fucked up because all your dopamine's gone. I had no idea, right? So the next day I'm like trying to eat more ecstasy. It's not working. I'm like, you know, just, and I'm, what the fuck is wrong? And I'm like, I should just kill myself. And I, you know, went on this like week bender after that to, you know, figure out what was going on. And then somebody finally told me, is like, yeah, man, like, you know, you can't do ecstasy and you're not, you're going to be fucked up the next day. Like, you know, I even tried shrooms like right after that. Like I was trying to, I felt so like horrible and couldn't figure out why that I was like, got a bag of shrooms and ate them. And it was a horrible experience. So anyways.
So with you talking about experiencing the thought of, you know, committing suicide and stuff like that, how did you get out of that rut?
Well, so so first I just want to say, like, I committed this crime when I was about 7 months without drugs or alcohol in my system. And it was something that, like, I just never, I never would have, I don't know, like, it blows my mind that it was something I did. I did assault and robbery. I went to a man's house and assaulted him and took his things. And even when I was out there, like, I did stuff like that, but if I did anything like that, I was extremely messed up. Like, it wasn't like a, you know, natural thing. And this thing was like planned out and it was crazy. And as soon as I got done doing it, like I had realized that I might be crazy, right? Like I didn't, cause a normal person wouldn't do this, especially not having anything in her system. And that moment in time, instead of like trying to figure out like, hey, you might be crazy, I like actually ran from it and pretended it didn't happen. So what happens for a guy like me anyways, over a period of time, if I'm not, you know, if I don't have something to numb stuff out, my conscience just it gets stronger. And so I committed this crime and hurt this individual, and all those things that I was doing up until this point to make myself feel better wasn't working. And all of a sudden I had like all this guilt, shame, and remorse. And so here we are, you know, a year and a half without a drink or drug in my system. And I'm thinking like killing myself is a good idea, because all this stuff that I've been doing is just, you know, it's I can't run from it anymore. Mm-hmm. So I hit this emotional bottom, and you know, the only two options I had at that moment, I thought, was either pick up a drink or kill myself. Yep. Luckily, I had been going to this fellowship for a while, and I went to this fellowship and kind of said, hey, I was struggling. I didn't say what was really going on. I just said I was struggling. And there was this man that came up to me, after this meeting, and he said, you know, if you want a way out, call me tomorrow. Right. And so I called him up, because I did. I didn't really want to kill myself, you know, but just at that time, it just seemed like the only option, because I couldn't live the way I was living. And I didn't want to drink, because I knew where I was at the very end of my drinking wasn't much different than that moment in time either. So, you know, I knew eventually like killing myself was just going to be the end result anyways. So I called the guy the next day, and we started this process. And, you know, he had a set of spiritual principles that he had been living by. And you know, he asked if I wanted to do that. And up until this point, you know, I'd met people that had done these spiritual principles. And I just thought it was like, you know, hokey pokey. You know, I thought it was just, you know, people that hadn't had a drink or drug in a long time, they just, you know, they talk about it, but no one actually does it, you know, but I believed him. I believed that, you know, whatever experience that he had, you know, he was telling me the truth, you know, and I really didn't have much else going on, you know. So we kind of started this process, and within a few months, I was really starting to see some results. And I was at his house one day, and we're doing some of this process, and I shared with him some of the things, like the crime I committed, and you know, the sexual assault that happened to me, and you know, just a list of things that I was gonna like take to the grave kind of stuff. You know, and he like didn't even really flinch. You know what I mean? Like I'm like, I got some shit. You know what I mean? I'm like giving him all the shit. And he's like not even, you know, I think he almost yawned one time. And I gotta tell you, is like, you know, he shared some stuff with me and I just had this moment that I hadn't had really ever, you know, of like really connecting with another human being. And really is what I've actually been looking for. Like I didn't know that's what I was looking for, you know, but that's what the booze gave me. It like gave me this connection, you know, whether it was with the bottle or with other people, but I had a connection. And that was the first time that the spiritual principles, I was like, oh shit, this is real. You know what I mean? Like I literally up until this point, I didn't think it was like real shit. Mm-hmm. And that really opened my eyes. And kind of from that moment on, I've pretty much done my best to like live by those principles. And you know, in the beginning, it's really bumpy, right? Because some of these principles that we learn is like you really have to look at the things that have been kind of causing us harm and others harm. And a lot of those things were like my survival mechanisms. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, you know, one of the reasons why I was in and out of relationships and why like I was a cheater was, you know, that was a defense mechanism that I, you know, picked up the first time I was cheated on. You know what I mean? Like, and I had no idea, you know.
That's the way you learned how to cope.
Exactly. The way I cope, you're not going to do it to me first kind of deal. And that was such an eye-opening thing. And right when that was, like, kind of shown to me and, like, the epiphany happened, I've never cheated ever since. You know what I mean? Like, as soon as that... Because it showed me what was really going on, you know. And sometimes when I'm struggling with we'll call them a defect of character. when I'm struggling with one of those things, sometimes I don't know why, right? And until, like, I see the real root of the cause of why I'm acting this way, sometimes I can't change it, you know. I can ask for help and I can get suggestions and I can learn little tricks and, you know, all these little things. But the reality is like, if I don't know why I do it, that gives me the relief, I'm going to probably keep doing it.
Yeah. You can't fix it. I learned that, I was doing EMDR. It's a type of therapy. Mm-hmm. I learned that, walking through that process, it's like, you know, this is why I have abandonment issues. You know, this is why this happened and this and this. And it kind of tracks you back to the beginning.
Yeah.
And it's like that crumb trail right back to this is why this is happening. This is the thoughts that you are having because of that trauma that happened years and years and years ago.
Yeah. Set fire.
It really did. It totally opened my mind too.
Nice.
Figure out, yeah.
Are you still doing it, or is that like a? I don't know much about it. I know we had a couple members in our organization do it, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. Is that something you still do, or is it like a?
I was doing it up until COVID hit, and then it's kind of a process. At least what I was doing, you have these like vibrators in each of your hands, and it like triggers.
Got him.
Yeah, here we go. That's what she said, right?
There it is. I was waiting to see who was going to say it first.
We got it. So it, from what I was doing, you needed it like physically in each hand type mm-hmm. of deal. So I figured with COVID, I can't do that virtually. So ever since, I haven't been back to do it. I don't feel the urge to right now. I feel pretty confident. It really helped when I did it.
Well, that's the great stuff about all this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. It's always there if you need it. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, you know, some of the practices that I do, it's almost like, you know, the relationship will change a little bit and then I'm like doing something else. Yeah, but I'm still doing some kind of spiritual practice. Like I'm still doing something, but it's always there when I come back. And there was some stuff that was taught to me, like really, you know, in those spiritual principles, like when I first started doing this, that was taught to me. And whenever I feel like, and I don't always do them, like I'm not doing them right now when I'm doing other things. But when I get to that place where I'm like feeling spiritually floating around, like mm-hmm. I'm not really feeling 100% connected everywhere. Like I'll go back to that, go right back to the basics. And that kind of like centers me, you know, mm-hmm. it's just, That's where the some of the stuff is just it's not something that I, because I get sometimes this idea that I need to be doing X, Y, and Z all the time, or I'm not whatever, and that's just not reality. You know, reality for me is like, you know, as long as I'm doing something to connect, and I'm doing that, I'm good. I don't have to do all of it. I was actually having a conversation with my girlfriend the other day about, you know, if you take all the things that is suggested for you to do, eating healthy, you know, like perfectly, you know, exercising perfectly, sleeping perfectly, like all these things, like that's a full-time job. Yeah. It's like literally a full-time job to be like, you know, to take a, and it's just, you know, if you have a life that I got, my life is crazy full, you know, with all the stuff that I got going on. So, you know, I just sometimes need to take myself down a notch because I still think I'm supposed to be, you know, this perfect being when, you know.
It's not reality. So what do you do on a daily basis to keep you centered, connected, keep you from walking back to that drink or that drug?
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Do you still have the timer, the Jesus timer or whatever?
I do. HB I don't call timer? It. Yeah, I call it. Yep, the God timer. Yep, I still have that. That was a practice that was. There's a program called Teen Challenge, and they have a practice that they do, where every hour you got to pray, and that's a little excessive for me. More of because. For it's about 2 hours when I start getting a little me orientated and not God orientated. Mm. It's right about 2 hours. So every hour I'm usually pretty good. It goes off. I'm like, I'm feeling good. But 2 hours is usually the thing. So it goes off. I usually then reset it for 2 hours later and whatnot. But there are times when, like, if I know I'm going to be in the middle of doing something, I'll, you know, put it out another couple hours later or whatever. And then there's sometimes like, you know, I do the F you God. I'm busy right now. And then 24 hours later when it goes off, I'm like, oh yeah, schmuck. Yeah. You ignored God.
Asshole. No, it's, I remember, we'll have to get back to this portion of it, but during our meetings, our work meetings,
yeah,
it would definitely go off.
Yeah.
And we would all stop.
Yes.
To just thank our HPs for...
Yeah, and I think it's such it's such a good practice, you know. If you're confident with whatever you believe in, right? Mm-hmm. If you feel that way, whenever it goes off, it's a great opportunity to be able to share that moment with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And like that's one of the things that I really enjoy is just being able to have a genuine moment with another human being. Because mm-hmm. you know we get so caught up at work or. You know, working out or, you know, fill in the blank. Like, we're so, like, you know.
It's just like drugs. You're filling that void. You're filling all this time. You're just filling up. And now, like you said, you have this connection
mm-hmm.
with other humans.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you always wanted
mm-hmm.
when you found
mm-hmm.
this individual mentor.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I don't know what to say.
Yeah, spiritual like, advisor,
there
you know,
we go.
Mentors, they're all the same, you know, they're all the same concept. Yeah, and like, and it's so true. Like, one of the things that I've loved about, and I was, you know, I shared about this earlier, like when we, or at least when I drink or drug, like I'm so in the present time,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, I was talking about all the feelings that I was having and I didn't know how to deal with them. As soon as I picked up a drink, that went away because it gave me the ability to be so fucking present
mm-hmm.
That nothing else mattered. And, you know, I'm trying to capture that today. It's just differently, right? I'm not trying to do that in a numb myself out way. It's of a I want to be present way, you know, but it's still the same kind of idea of being present in the here and the now. And a lot of people have read that book, The Power of Now, but it's a good read. I mean,
Eckhart Tolle can never go wrong.
Boom,
Mr. Tolle, he's good.
If you want anything, just grab one of his. You know what I mean? You're a good start. You know, you're in a good place if you get one of those books.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Yeah.
So, back to how
you let's get it back. Let's go back here.
How you stay spiritual every day, or like what you do to not pick up a drink or a drug.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think one of the biggest things is the morning routine. If I don't start off in a good space in the morning, that could really dictate how my day is going to be, you know, how present I can be, all those things. So for me, I got to start off, and I'm currently listening to about 10 minutes of some kind of meditation. It's usually guided. Today I listened to, you know, there's like these YouTube videos where, you know, somebody's like talking about, you know, the most, you know, actually today I listened to the how billionaires start off their day or something like that. Okay. And, you know, and they mapped out what they do. It took about seven to 10 minutes of, like, you know, what they do. And that, like, centers me. Is like, one, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, right? And because a lot of the stuff that individual is doing is, oh, that's what I do. But then it was like, oh, here are some other things that you can do that could also benefit you. So I usually do some kind of that, some kind of guided something. Sometimes lately I've been into journaling. I think journaling is a helpful tool for me. And sometimes that's some type of like an inventory, better myself kind of stuff. Yep. And sometimes it's just like writing all the crazy stuff that's going on in my mind that I don't want to accidentally say later. sometimes it's, you know, reviewing some goals that I've made, you know, and doing kind of like a spot check with that stuff. Sometimes it's I about once a week I write out a prayer. So, you know, I have struggles like anybody else, and when something's really got me kind of twisted, I'll write out a prayer. Like, you know, lately I've been struggling with food. I'm coming to terms that I might be a food addict. I'm coming to terms to this.
I don't know. I think I got you beat with the Oreos.
What do you mean? I just hammered Oreos the last couple of days, actually.
Sleeves at a time. Package at a time.
Well, so I'm better in the sense. So I don't know how this happened, but I'm a mint Oreo guy, and like regular Oreo packages of mint, I have not seen. They only sell the family size. Like, what the fuck are you doing to me? Like, I have.
I mean, either way, if you had an option between both of them, both on the shelf,
I try to do damage control. No.
We can't control, you know that.
That's my point. That's why I don't buy the family pack, because I'm going to eat all of it. Man, so I usually am better. Like, I only eat, so a family size sleeve. So there's three sleeves.
Yeah.
I'll eat just one, but sometimes I'll do one and a half. And that's like, that's control for me, by the way. That's, you know. So anyways, I'm coming to terms with my food/sugar addiction.
Yeah.
So part of my prayer was that I wrote out was in conjunction with that, you know, and so kind of like whatever I'm going through, usually once a week, I have something that comes up that I need to write about.
Right.
And I just write it out. And I write it out like a letter. When I was incarcerated, I read this book. I believe it was called Communications with God. I believe is what it was called. And man, it opened up to my eyes the power of writing. And basically this person's experience was, you know, they were like writing to God in meditation. And it was like, he was like getting answers back, you know, as he was writing. So a lot of times when I'm writing out a prayer, there's like things that come to me as I'm doing that. And I typically check that with somebody, because I'm not always God inspired.
Well, I always hear like you pray, you're speaking to God, and you meditate, you're listening to God type of deal.
Yeah. It's a conversation. Typically the people that, you know, I work with in recovery, that's what we talk about. Like, we talk about the, you know, one of the things that is really important is that relationship with whatever you believe in, and making the time to be in that relationship. So if we think about somebody we love, whether it's a partner or your mother, it doesn't really matter. But if you think about somebody you love, what do you do with that person? You make time for them. right? You set time aside. I'm going to see you on this day. And, you know, if you're in a relationship, you got to make date nights. And, you know, you're doing all these things because you value that person. And you want to spend time with them. Relationship with my creator is not anything different. Like, if I value that relationship, I need to make time for it. So that's what prayer meditation is for me. It's setting time aside to, like, say, here I am, like, let's talk about some shit, you know? Yeah. And that's been one of the most, for me, that's been one of the most staples. And I've gone through periods of not doing it consistently. And what tends to happen for me is my quote-unquote anger issues come back. My ability to, you know, see rightly starts to go to the wayside. And I all of a sudden I start waking up with discomfort, disease. I'm just not content.
How do you keep it consistent? I feel like, because I was on the same boat, that's what I did. Mm. Prayer, meditation, every morning. Mm-hmm. And I would get on this great run. And then I would have a little hiccup.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just kept falling off.
Yeah.
And now I don't do anything.
Yeah. Shh, I won't tell anybody. I won't tell anybody. I will not tell your million listeners. Well, you know, there's some literature that I read, and it says that you know, we're gonna be defiant when it comes to prayer, and when that happens, you know, it's just get back to it as soon as you can. It's basically what he said. I'm paraphrasing, but it's basically what it says.
Right.
You know, and really that's it. As soon as I notice that I'm kind of off the beam, as they say, it's just getting back to it. And again, I have to, for me, it's like I can't be like, oh, I was doing 30 minutes every morning. I don't got time for 30 minutes, so I can't do it. Right? I get in that mindset, it's all or nothing, when it's like, no, dude, just take 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. Just take 2 minutes and start there. My buddy Ian, whenever he works with anybody, that's how he ropes them into prayer and meditation. He says, you can take 2 minutes in the morning, right? All right, just take 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody can do 2 minutes,
right?
It's that same concept of, you know, everybody can not drink for one day. You know what I mean? Same concept. It's just, if you got, just take 2 minutes in the morning, that's all you need. And
it's like that 20 minutes of exercise. You have time to scroll. You have time to work out.
There you go.
You always hear something of that. Yeah.
Do it at the same time.
Ooh, I like it.
Yeah,
I probably won't do it, even though I like it. But anyway.
So, you know, that's pretty much kind of what I do. I also try to do some reading, and I change up daily reflections, and, you know, some kind of daily spiritual reading, and sometimes I crack open the old Christian Bible. Right now, one of the readings that I really enjoy is it's called "Living in Buddha and Living in Christ." Or is it Living in Christ, Living in Buddha? Anyways,
You're living between both of them.
Well, concept. It's
in the title,
right? Exactly. There's some living, and there's some Christ, and there's some Buddha. Just, you know, Google it. I'm sure Google knows the answer. But it's really great because most Buddhist kind of books are written so you can do them in like a meditation or a daily prayer kind of practice. You know, they really believe in, like, you know, less is more, which is, that's the other thing I struggle with. Like, when I am not doing everything in one day, I enjoy the things that I do. But, like, I have this mind and, you know, it's just like, I want to do it all today. Mm-hmm. And I have a hard time enjoying my life sometimes because I'm doing it all. Right. Anyways, Buddha practice, they're usually, you know, less is more. So the way this is broken up, it does that, and I really enjoy that because it, especially when it comes to any kind of like Buddhist writing. I mean, like, it's just, it's so much. It's like sometimes you read a page and you're like, oh my god, you know, I gotta take all that in this little mind. But anyways, it's a really good book. He does a great job of kind of seeing the parallels to the, you know, Christ and Buddha. Mm-hmm. So definitely recommend it.
What a routine. I wish I had that.
Yeah.
I'll get there. Right?
You'll get there.
I'll get
one
there.
One day at a time. Just starts with 2 minutes.
2 minutes.
Or 1 minute.
1 minute. I have time. I have time. Okay. So I'm super eager before we finish up to talk about how we met.
Oh my.
And like what our journey was together. You and I met in 2013 when I got sober at the BYP.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Burlington Young Peoples.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. It's nice, nice fellowship of young people there. And that definitely, yeah, it was a beautiful thing. I mean, still going strong.
Yeah.
Still going strong.
We did a lot of YPods together.
Young people. Yep. Yep.
Those were fun.
I love
them. I miss those. I can't wait.
They're coming.
I can't wait.
They're coming in hot. They've been doing all right, you know, doing with the Zoom online world. I've been to a couple. Obviously, it's nothing like the, you know, people trying to put a bid together to bring to Vermont. And a lot of them never even been to one before. And it's like, you know, they might have checked out some online stuff, but they have no idea.
They really don't.
They have no idea. So
you know what I think about a lot is... When you told me that you went to a YPAW and you guys were doing a dance where you all wore headphones.
It's amazing.
That's
the most amazing thing ever.
I think about that all the time and how much I want to do it. So you explained it as everyone goes to the dance floor with headphones, but there's two separate songs happening. Mm-hmm. So you don't know who's dancing to what.
Typically got two DJs.
And if okay.
Yeah, sometimes you got two DJs. Sometimes it's one, but typically you got two different DJs. It's amazing. I mean, it's called, what do they call it? Disco ball, I think is what they call it. And I guess it's like a thing. It's not just a YPAW thing. I guess they do that in like, in the real world, quote unquote.
Yeah.
But it is just so cool. You get these headphones and they're color coordinated. So red will be one DJ, blue will be another DJ.
Okay.
So everybody's in there. And if you walk by it, right, because you don't hear the music unless you have the headphones on. So if you walk by his room, you just see these like, 50, 100 people with these like little lights on their head. And they're just like, ah, and they're like yelling and no one's in tune and everyone's singing something different. And you're like, what the fuck? It's amazing. It is amazing. And like when you're with your crew and then like you're listening to a red and they're on a blue and you look around and they're fucking tweaking out. You're like, why are they tweaking out? And then you switch over to the blue and you're like, oh my God. And it's like, oh man, epic.
I think about that often. I would love to do one.
Oh, it's amazing.
Oh man.
Well, if we ever get anything up this way, again, that's definitely going to be my recommendation.
Yeah.
Because it is the fucking coolest thing ever.
Oh, I love it.
Not a lot of things that I'm like, that's the coolest thing ever. That's fucking coolest thing ever.
That's fucking cool.
Yeah.
So we met in 2013.
Yep.
We did some fellowshipping together.
Yep.
And then you got me a job.
Oh, J-O-B. Can't get those bennies, but.
with Vermont Foundation of Recovery. It was probably one of the best experiences I had.
Oh, that's good.
I loved it.
We had another colleague I don't think would say the same thing.
In the heat of the moment at certain times, I would not say that.
Mm-hmm.
But now, out of it and looking back, it was just amazing.
It was
yeah. Because I work with my best friends.
Hi-o.
And I'm helping people in recovery.
Mm.
So tell us. What is V4?
Oh, Vermont Foundation of Recovery. What an amazing thing. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, me being almost 18 years sober is fucking mind-blowing, but also the development of this organization is mind-blowing to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll paint the picture.
Yeah.
So I'm this dude that's incarcerated. You know, as I shared before, I committed a crime in sobriety and I was about 2 years sober when I actually went to jail for the crime I committed. It was part of me cleaning up the past,
mm-hmm.
and I had to go to jail for 3 years for the crime I committed. So I had 2 years of sobriety, going to jail for three. So towards the end of that stay, right, I did a bunch of spiritual work. You know, I walked with some, people that studied Hinduism, and I walked with some Christian individuals, you know, met some people that studied Buddhism, like, you know, it's like anything you want is in jail. So God, you know, for me, like my God, like would always put a new person in my way of life. And I believe in onimism, as I say it.
I have no idea.
Oh my God. It's great. It's basically means that, what I believe is, all religions have some truth, but none of them have the truth. Right. So I like it. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. It's, you know, what I believe in. So, like, it was just amazing, like, having that belief, God, I just felt it kept putting these different people in my life. Mm-hmm. So, anyways, towards the end of my stay, like, I was getting out, right? And up until this point, I didn't really think about, you know, hey, what are you going to do after jail? It just, you know, it was in the moment. It was focusing on, you know, becoming the best me I could be in there and blah, 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 blah. And so when that time came, I'm like, oh, shit, like, I'm getting out. Like, I got to figure this out. So I had, like, you know, come to Jesus moment, as some people would say. I'm like, God, what the fuck am I doing with my life? Two things kind of came out of my heart. One was to become like a personal trainer. I've always liked fitness since, you know, getting in recovery, and I'm personables, and I like working with people. I like showing and teaching and results, and I love all that shit. But then the other thing he put on my heart was creating like this this place for people to go that wanted to change their lives. Mm-hmm. And what I was seeing with people coming into jail is a lot of times they'd come into jail, and when they would get out, they'd go exactly in the same spot they were before they left. Mm-hmm. And it didn't really matter how much they changed.
Right.
Right? They went right back to the same place. And I was like, that's stupid. Right. Like, why would you have somebody change and then throw them right back in the lines then? So I get out, and like, right before I got out, like, I created this big idea, and I'm a thinker. I'm like a, you know, extravagant. I'm like, I got this ginormous facility that I created, and like, you know, I'm trying to figure out how much it's going to be. No experience with any of this. I'm just fucking. So anyways, I get out, and about 6 months, I went to somebody in the Department of Corrections, and I said, hey, I got this idea. And they're like, all right, why don't you talk to this person? So I went and talked to this person, and they're like, yeah, you should start a nonprofit. I'm like, not a what? You know, like, I don't know. What is that? And they're like, oh, what you need to do is, and they listed off the stuff I have to do. Now, if anybody knows anything about getting out of jail, you don't have time to fucking do anything. You know, I had to do programming twice a week. I had to work full time. I didn't have a license, so I had to bus it, which in our area, like, you know, where I was, it was anywhere from an hour, a half an hour to an hour and a half, yep. You know, so you have to map out, you know, so I'm like, nonprofit, like, get all this, like, how the fuck am I going to do that? Like, I had no idea. So I found an easier, softer way. there's a gentleman that, you know, really helped me in early recovery, our buddy Nate. And, you know, if I really wouldn't be here if it wasn't for him. And he, you know, he's a guy that's been really good with money and property, and like, you know, that's his mind works that way. Yeah. And so he had a property, and I was like, hey dude, you're losing money. Why don't you let me turn this into a recovery home? You don't even have to give me any money. I'll do all the work.
Right.
And he said, okay. And, so the first couple of years I had this recovery home, and we were, the first home to ever allow medication, any kind of recovery home. If there was a recovery home, you know, medications were a no-no. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people that were on anything, it didn't matter what it was. I mean, like, you would be lucky if you could take a vitamin B12, you know, it's just, right. They were just so rigid, and, you know, they just came from a background that's you know what, that's still out there, and it still works for some people. So I don't think, you know, it's just, there wasn't any other option. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my first recovery home, a couple of years, didn't make it, you know, I wasn't getting paid to do it. It was all just a labor of love. I just saw the need and wanted to do it. And I had no idea that little thought that I had, I believe was from God in jail, and then getting out and doing this labor of love for a couple of years, would turn into that nonprofit organization with 6 recovery homes, 4 transitional apartments, serving about, you know, 45 people, you know, staffing managers, and many of them like yourself or somebody in recovery that want to get in the field. And, you know, it just blows my mind. Like, it literally went from like just this little thought and following it, you know? So one of the things that I like when I'm talking to people about this stuff, it's like when something is put on your heart, don't worry about money, you know? And Alan Watts, you know, he talks about this. So like, if you do whatever you like to do, somebody, and you become an expert on it, eventually someone is going to give you money for it. Because everybody has something they want. Whatever it is that you want to do, somebody's going to want that. Like, it's just the way the world works. You know, like if you can build model cars and you become the best model car maker ever, like somebody's going to pay for that.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And so eventually this like little thing that I felt God put on my heart turned into this, you know, I mean, we're still a really small organization, but it went from one house to six houses and four transitional apartments and paid full-time people. And it just blows my mind.
I mean, I wouldn't call it small. I'm going to be honest. That's the biggest community of sober homes in Vermont.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, yes. When it comes to recovery housing, you know, and I'm super proud of this too. Like, you know, we're the kind of the leaders when it comes to recovery homes. You know, with the way we do things, and, you know, we were able to get, because recovery homes aren't really certified, and there is a server, a body out there, NAR, National Association of Recovery Residencies, that a state can become an affiliate of, and then they can certify recovery homes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, David Regal is, you know, my boss, who's the other guy. You know, again, I wouldn't be here without him. Mm-hmm. You know, him and I partnered up, and him and I started going to NAR, and we started learning about all this stuff. So right when we had the opportunity, we convinced some bigwigs in the state of Vermont to, like, hey, you guys should do this. And they did it. And then we were able to become the first homes to be certified in the state of Vermont. So just crazy.
That happened when I was working with you.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a huge accomplishment.
Yeah.
And then you guys moved from all these different surrounding towns, say Chittenden area, and now you guys are all like compact together.
Well, so the ones in Chittenden are all going to be compact.
Yeah.
Where it's going to be, it's a different model than we're used to. You know, because, you know, everything is like spread out a little bit. But we're going to have everything kind of in one spot. We're going to see how it goes. We're going to be able to help families, which has been, you know, increasing need. Yeah. So, you know, the way this setup is going to be, we're going to have like these three buildings. One building is going to be for women, one building's for men, and in the middle are going to be the transitional apartment. Those transitional apartments are also going to be able to you know, house families in recovery. Yeah, we're super stoked about that. We're also opening up in Barrie, Vermont here pretty soon, and we're partnering with a couple other organizations, and it's literally going to be for, you know, women that have children that are in recovery.
Yep.
It's going to be straight up set up for that. We should be in Rutland here in a couple months. It's almost there, almost ready to pull the trigger. Our goal is to be a lot like, you know, we want to have the same philosophy as CCV. They say, like, you know, there's a campus 45 minutes, in no longer than 45 minutes than where you live or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We want the same ideas. Like, wherever you live, we want to make sure there's a recovery home, you know, more like 30 minutes from where you live.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we do men and women. And I think the transitional apartments is another thing that...
What are transitional apartments?
Thank you for asking.
I know, but others don't.
So that's another thing that, you know, other recovery homes don't do, right? They don't. This isn't a service that they provide. So one of the things that we provide is after somebody's got, you know, about 6 months of recovery and everything's stable, you know, whether it's their, you know, mental health stuff or whether it's work, you know, or they have, you know, steady income coming in, the recovery's 100, they can go into the transitional apartment. And the transitional apartment is basically a two-bedroom apartment. You would be, you know, that individual and another person in recovery that has 6 months. And then they would start learning how to do things like pay monthly versus weekly. So we charge, you know, about $150 a week for the membership cost. You know, they would move in a transitional apartment. It's about $650. Then they have to pay the bills, you know, so they have to figure that out with their roommate. And they have to start figuring out, like, you know, who's doing what, right? Because, you know, when you're in the recovery home, like, it's all figured out for you. bills are figured out, the way we do chores, like everything's mapped out to, you don't have to figure out anything. Then you got to go and you, now you're living with somebody and you got to figure out how to have those tough conversations.
Yeah.
So ideally we've gave them the skills to be able to do that before they get there. Because, you know, when you're at a recovery home, as you know, stuff comes up and we have to figure out how to talk about it like adults.
Right.
So when they go to the transitional apartment, there is still some oversight, but it's just a lot less. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a lot less. They're not seeing, you know, managers as much. You know, we still do UAs, but it's, you know, once a month or maybe even less, depending on what's going on.
And what's a UA?
It's a UA is a urinalysis assessment, right? UAs, I think that's how you, urinalysis assessment. There we go. That's, you know, they have to clean a cup and we send that to a lab. And then that lab says this is in their system or it's not.
Right, right. You guys have some great partnerships too. Throughout the whole community, a lot of support.
Absolutely. You know, the urinalysis is, you know, we've been working with a Spenty Health for a really long time. You know, before that, they were Burlington Labs. Mm-hmm. We work a little bit with Dominion. They're also another lab company. Both of them have just been phenomenal. You know, we get mainly our tests from a Spenty, but, you know, Dominion's helped out so much financially, giving money. And, you know, they're the ones that actually started a fund. We call it the Dominion Housing Scholarship Fund. Mm-hmm. They donated, I think it was $10,000 to start this fund. And it was, you know, basically for people that are moving in and that have any money, which is majority of our population comes in with no money.
Right. Super helpful.
Oh, man. That was such a big help. And, you know, we work with other people too, like the project that we had at Fort, the project that we're doing at Fort Ethan Allen is CHT, Chittenden Housing Trust. And they've been phenomenal. This relationship we've been, you know, working with them has been just perfect. I mean, you know, we don't own any of the properties. Right. You know, we decided early on, Dave and I and the board of directors decided that we didn't actually want to be homeowners. You know, we weren't in it to own anything. So we started out by just finding landlords that we, you know, believed in our cause, basically, and gave us something that was affordable that we could, you know, be able to make our organization run. But there was a lot of headaches, you know. Some landlords are really good at doing things and some landlords are just not. And this partnership with CHT has just been perfect because they have everything. They have maintenance crew. They have, you know, everything is set up so we don't even have to worry about it, right? We have point people that we call whenever we need anything. And
you don't have to make the girls mow the lawn anymore?
No, no. Any members mow the lawn. Yeah.
That's good. Okay, so if I needed housing, mm-hmm. How and when would be, like, how would I do it?
That's a very good question.
Right.
So any stage of recovery, you know, you could just go online. And our website is www.vfor, that's V as in Victor, R as in Roger, V. Let's start this over. V as in Victor, F as in Frank, O as in, we'll do Olive, R as in Roger.org.
I will also have that in the description.
Thank God. Thank God. That was tough for me. And basically, you just go to our website, which we just upgraded.
Oh my God, I can't wait to see it.
Looking fresh. Ooh. Looking fresh. And it's, you know, big bold letters says apply here. If you want to volunteer, if you're looking for internship, any of that stuff, you can find all that on the website.
Now, if I came out of jail, would you guys accept me?
Yeah, we accept pretty much anybody from any walk of life. Yep. I mean, basically the idea is if you're looking for recovery and you're looking for a safe place to live while you figure out the recovery piece, we're it. So we get people from incarceration. We get people from treatment facilities in state, out of state. We get sometimes people right off the street. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, we don't exactly recommend. I mean, we don't require like
a set amount of time.
Not really. I mean, you got to be able to pass a urinalysis, right. UA, and as long as you know. there are certain things that stay in your system for a certain amount of time. So we might be able to work with individuals around that situation. But, and they just can't be like visibly detoxing, you know, right. we don't do that.
You can't be half dying when you walk in the door, and you can't be stumbling cause you're shitty.
Yep.
So.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
I love it. I worked there for 2 years or so.
Yeah. I mean, we still, I think have you on our payroll just in case. Just in case we can get you back.
And I love it. I love it. So yeah, that's where we're at. And now we're besties.
Forever. Let's get it, Outcast.
Okay, so we recapped a whole bunch of shit. Went over your story. Just so much. I love it all. But we're at that time.
Oh, good. I got to pee. Okay. That's great. No, perfect timing.
Perfect timing.
I thought I was going to have to pee in this bottle. Awkward.
Okay. So let's just end with what's one takeaway that you hope our listeners get after listening to this episode?
Oh, man. Oof. There's so many. I mean, I think the biggest thing is it honestly, it doesn't matter what it is you're struggling with. There's a way out. It does take a little time, but there's a way out.
There's hope. There's a way out. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
You're not alone.
That's it.
All those cliches that we hear.
Oh.
So true.
Well, you spoke about Maple Leaf. We have one of the signs that says no longer alone.
Yes.
We're looking for a place to put it. We just don't know where.
In the new office right next to my picture.
It's ginormous, though.
It is. And for those who don't know, Maple Leaf was a rehab center.
Yeah. Yep. People stayed there for about 30 days, and they had two signs. One was on the building that as soon as you got there and you started walking up, it said, you're no longer alone. And then they had pretty much the identical sign over by their pond. They had this big pond.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much identical. And a gentleman that worked there actually got the one that was on the building. And we were able to finagle the one that was by the pond. So
it's awesome.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll be able to keep the memory alive with that.
Yeah.
A lot of people's stories start with that sign. So.
Uh-huh. I remember all of us sharing our stories there at one
mm-hmm.
point.
Mm-hmm.
I remember traveling up there and stuff. Okay. Lastly.
This is it. I thought the last was the last.
No, I know. Phew. Okay, so no, this is the last one. Where can we find you? Give us social media.
Oh, wow. I thought you were going for the Social Security.
The SS. You know?
Yeah, I think I'm not a huge social media guy.
No,
just
give us your cell phone and address.
But I got but I am on Facebook. I'm just not on there a lot.
Yeah.
And it's just my first and last name. Be careful, there is an Andrew Gagne that lives in St. Albans and we're like the same age and all that fun shit. And somebody was like telling me this crazy story about they thought it was me. I was like, Brian, me? Come to find out, there's another dude like me that's over there. Anyways, Andrew Gagne is my name, Gonyea. I mean, my number is 802-3433. I mean, it's on Facebook, so.
Oh, okay. Well, here we are.
Mm-hmm.
I will put that also in the description.
Oh.
Is it?
There it is.
You guys. Right now.
We're about to have it. 2 minutes.
This is the timer for us to pray. And Andrew is praying right now as I finish up. Thank you guys for listening. We enjoyed you guys. I'm trying to fill time. He is still praying. Hold on.
I can stop. I'm not gonna.
No. I got it.
That's a Native American flute, Mary Youngblood, if you're interested.
Oh.
Phenomenal stuff.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Well, let's wrap up. Thank you so much, Andrew. Thank you so much for coming. I really appreciate it. And awesome. I can't wait to do it again.
Yes. Oh, I love you so much.